Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, February 8th, 2024. In debate over reopening, Visit Marfa Facebook page becomes hotspot. By Stephen Paulson. Marfa. Since the city of Marfa runs the Marfa Visitor Center, its website, and until recently, a dedicated Instagram, locals and visitors might assume that city leaders also run a related Visit Marfa Facebook page. Some city leaders assume the same. But there's no formal connection, and now city leaders are planning to beef up their own social media presence for tourists due to a difference in philosophy with the main Visit Marfa page concerning the coronavirus. While tourism in Marfa has become a hot-button topic during the pandemic, the Visit Marfa page has remained an unabashed supporter of tourism in the region. But as the debate on everything from lockdown measures to face mask recommendations becomes increasingly partisan, the city of Marfa is wary of locals or residents perceiving tourist boosterism as its official city stance. Some city leaders were not even initially sure who was running the page. Dan Dunlap, a former Marfa mayor and current city contractor, started the Visit Marfa Facebook page around 2008 while he was mayor. For a while, Patrick Rivera, Marfa's assistant director of tourism, helped run it, further cementing the association some Marfans have between the page and official city outreach efforts. But Dunlap parted ways with Rivera earlier this year, Dunlap said in an interview last week. A move, he said, had nothing to do with the current debate in Marfa over how to balance desires for tourist dollars with concerns about public safety. Instead, Dunlap said, he had used his own credit card to pay to boost a post on the site. And since my credit is going to be on the line here, Dunlap decided to remove Rivera and become the only administrator. By Monday night, the city had removed its official Visit Marfa Instagram page, Visit Marfa TX. Mayor Manny Baeza said the city wanted to streamline its online information for visitors, noting that it had been difficult to keep up with all of the different social media accounts. That page is going to be removed, Baeza said. He said the city wanted to funnel visitors into several designated sites, including official web pages run by the city, the Marfa Police, the Marfa Library, and the Marfa Visitors Center. The developments are part of a growing divide over how this tourist region should respond to the current coronavirus pandemic, which has surged across Texas in recent weeks. Officials in both Presidio and Brewster counties have warned of possible spread, citing accelerating case counts in the region. The Facebook page has received fresh attention during the pandemic as it continues its core mission of directing visitors to Marfa businesses and area events. Texas leaders have been reopening the state for weeks and have overturned local rules meant to slow the spread of coronavirus, from face mask ordinances in Houston and the city of Presidio to the temporary ban on short-term rentals in Presidio County. But Tri-County residents remain conflicted on whether local leaders should encourage visitors to the region. And some local businesses remain closed or to go by appointment only. In the past week, the Visit Marfa Facebook page has posted more than a dozen times, including posts about local hotels, menu items at local restaurants and tourist attractions like Big Bend National Park. By contrast, the official Visit Marfa Instagram page hadn't posted since February when it remarked on a snow day. "I've taken the stance of not promoting tourism as much," Rivera, the assistant tourism director who runs that page, said of his approach to the current pandemic. Rivera declined to comment on the Visit Marfa Facebook page or on the broader debate over how to balance economic needs against coronavirus precautions. Multiple city officials said they were not aware of Rivera receiving any specific directives or policies regarding how to handle social media posts and promotions in general, given the circumstances. Rivera said he posted when the city directed him to, for instance, by sharing in an Instagram story when there was an update to local coronavirus measures. But he said he had been cautious about promoting tourism during the pandemic. There are other things that are important, he said, namely the safety of people who live here. Dunlap told the Big Bend Sentinel that he's received compliments and thank yous, not complaints, for his recent efforts to continue promoting local businesses on Facebook. He also said he removed any links that might confuse readers about a formal connection with the city. Instead, Dunlap said he's happy to continue promoting businesses in his personal capacity as a resident. And if city leaders don't want me promoting Marfa, that's just too bad. The virus is terrible, he added, but destroying the economy is worse. On the Visit Marfa page, Dunlap has at times addressed this difference of opinion. In May, for example, a woman posted on the page to inquire whether Marfa currently wanted tourists. So does Marfa want people to come visit or stay away for a while? She wrote, confused by things I have read. Please come and enjoy our beautiful weather and scenery, Dunlap replied. He added that the town is learning to open safely, as were surrounding towns and parks. At a city council meeting last week, Buck Johnston, a council member and local business owner, asked other city leaders about the page, noting that she had received questions and complaints about it. The complaint was that the Visit Marfa page was encouraging tourism too soon and too early, she said in an interview Tuesday. The issue prompted some confusion at the meeting. City leaders quickly determined that Rivera was no longer updating the page, but weren't immediately sure who was running it. It didn't take long to clear the air, though. The next day, Dunlap called Mandy Roan, the city's director of community services, to clarify that he had started the page and is still running it. Roan stressed there was no dispute between Dunlap and the city. He created the page, so it's his page, she said. Roan didn't think anyone from the city had asked to be added back to the account. Instead, Marfa city leaders are considering another tack, setting up their own online landing site for visitors. At press time, the details on that plan are still vague, with suggestions ranging from a new Facebook page and social media presence to more updates on the official visitmarfa.com website. You have to remember, this is all pretty new, said Mayor Baeza. City Attorney Teresa Todd said she was among the city officials who believed the Visit Marfa Facebook page was run by the city. She said the city wanted to clear up the confusion for both residents and tourists. For me, the issue is to make sure there's separation between the city-owned website and this Visit Marfa page that Dan started, she said. I think it's in a different place and has different goals. The situation is a case study in how Marfans have split over coronavirus, coronavirus precautions, and the ensuing national partisan divide over both. Marfans, many of whom work in or run tourist-oriented businesses, have often been united in their support of having a steady stream of tourists through the area. But coronavirus has changed that. And soon, there could be two Facebook pages geared towards visitors. One that prioritizes revving the Marfa economy back to life, and another that prioritizes public safety. Meet the candidates at Saturday's forum in Presidio. Presidio, want to hear directly from candidates on their priorities for the county? Make plans to attend the Presidio County Candidates Forum, sponsored by the Big Bend Sentinel, on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Presidio Senior Citizens Center, 1400 O'Reilly in Presidio. Trey Gerfers, Presidio County Underground Water Conservation District Manager, will moderate the forum. All candidates are running in the March 5th Democratic primary for county races. Since no local Republican candidates are on the ballot for that primary, it's likely that winners of the Democratic primary will be elected in the November general election. Candidates must achieve at least 50% of the vote in the primary to avoid a runoff with any second-place finishers. Presidio County is entering a new era with tremendous opportunities for funding and infrastructure, Gerfers said. It is vital that we have the best possible public officials at the county level at this time. The candidates' forum will provide voters with the information they need to make these important choices. Invited candidates include Robert Bentley Acosta, Constable Precinct 2, Tubercio Butch Acosta, Commissioner Precinct 3, Nancy Valdez Arevalo, Tax Assessor Collector, Ruben Armendariz Jr., Commissioner Precinct 1, Jose Luis Cabezuela, Commissioner Precinct 3, Aiden Pug Covos Jr., Constable Precinct 2, Danny Dominguez, Sheriff, Deirdre E. Heisler, Commissioner Precinct 1, Esteban Steve Marquez, Constable Precinct 1, Francisco Frankie Ortiz, Commissioner Precinct 3, Blair Park, County Attorney, Rod Pontone, County Attorney, Ramon Rodriguez, Democratic Chair, Irma Carrasco Sanchez, Commissioner Precinct 3, Samuel Sanchez Spencer, Commissioner Precinct 1, Norma Valenzuela, Tax Assessor Collector. Constable candidates will not participate in questions and answers. Early voting begins on Tuesday, February 20th, and ends on Friday, March 1st, for the Tuesday, March 5th primaries. State and national candidates will also be on the ballot for both parties. Voters may cast their ballots in only one party's primary. Sample ballots are available on the elections page of the county website at co.presidio.tx.us. Voter registration ended February 5th, but registered voters should be prepared to have an acceptable form of identification when headed to the polls. You can find a list of acceptable identification at www.votexas.org. See article on page 3 of this issue of the Sentinel for responses from county attorney and tax assessor collector candidates to our questionnaire, and check back next week for county commissioner and constable candidate responses. Be sure to check the Sentinel Facebook page at www.facebook.com/TheBigBendSentinel for updates and news on the candidate forum. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. Village Farms Marfa Greenhouse Facility Manager Abby Lange shows 7th graders Adeline Marquez, Heidi Montez, and Ulysses Estrada a box containing European bumblebees, which the company uses to pollinate its tomato crops. Mexico's suit against American gun manufacturers revived in appeals court. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Boston. The Mexican government's lawsuit against a handful of American gun manufacturers was revived late last month in the First Circuit Court of Appeals after being dismissed by a lower court judge in 2022. The suit, which alleges that bad business practices by these companies have exacerbated cartel violence, is the first of its kind filed by a foreign country. For decades, the government and its citizens have been victimized by a deadly flood of military-style and other particularly lethal guns that flows from the U.S. across the border, reads the suit's original complaint. This flood is not a natural phenomenon or an inevitable consequence of the gun business or of U.S. gun laws. Mexico suffers the third highest rate of gun-related deaths in the world, despite having extremely strict laws prohibiting firearms. The country is home to a single gun store that grants fewer than 50 permits a year, primarily to government officials, journalists, and other individuals particularly at risk for being targeted by the cartels. The suit claims that 70 to 90% of illegal firearms recovered at Mexican crime scenes were made in the U.S., the majority made by defendants Smith & Wesson, Beretta, Century Arms, Colt, Glock, and Ruger. An estimated 500,000 guns are trafficked from the United States into Mexico every year. A gun manufactured in the U.S. is more likely to be used to murder a Mexican citizen than an American citizen, the complaint says, citing statistics from 2019. In September of 2022, a district court judge in Massachusetts struck down the lawsuit on the grounds that it violated the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, PLCAA, a law that protects gun manufacturers from liability for harm caused by their products. Prior to the bill's passage, gun manufacturers were sued fairly regularly by cities like New York, Boston, and San Francisco, which had limited or outlawed gun sales, but still struggled to combat significant rates of gun-related homicides with firearms trafficked in from out of town. The First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston picked the case back up in part by the argument that the gun industry's conduct allegedly violates the predicate exception of the PLCAA, which exempts manufacturers from protection if they cause harm by knowingly engaging in illegal conduct. The suit alleges that the industry adheres to willfully blind, standardless distribution practices that put military-grade weapons into the hands of cartels with serious profit to gain. We've created a monster. Guns are bought and sold in a three-tiered process. They're built by manufacturers and sold to distributors, who in turn sell them to individual dealers. In the U.S., dealers tend to cluster in border states and, on average, make double the annual sales of dealers elsewhere. With just over 6,000 federally registered dealers in Texas, the state is home to nearly six times the number of gun stores than McDonald's franchises. The suit alleges that manufacturers are using a head-in-the-sand approach and aren't doing everything they can or are legally bound to do to prevent their guns from ending up in the hands of problematic downstream buyers. Instead, the plaintiffs argue that the industry is propped up by straw sales, multiple sales, and repeat sales. In other words, bulk sales to people who are clearly buying weapons on behalf of people who legally can't purchase them. The suit acknowledges that tracing guns from the factory floor to the scene of a crime can be difficult, but that gun manufacturers could easily implement practices to trace crime guns back to the point of sale. One suggestion of many, to circumvent destroyed serial numbers, manufacturers could inscribe an additional hidden serial number inside the gun for use by law enforcement. Another issue cited in the complaint is the marketing of military-grade weapons to a civilian market over the past 20 years, after a ban on semi-automatic assault weapons was lifted in 2004. The suit singles out a .50 caliber sniper rifle manufactured by defendant Barrett Firearms Manufacturing, Inc., that has become a weapon of choice for Mexican cartels. The 82A1 can shoot down helicopters and penetrate lightly armored vehicles. Barrett's advertising is not subtle. "We've created a monster," boasts a magazine ad cited by the plaintiffs. Jonathan Lowy of Global Action on Gun Violence, a nonprofit that aims to inspire change in the gun industry through litigation, is part of a team representing Mexico in court. He stressed that the call for enhanced regulation wasn't intended to punish law-abiding dealers. "The overwhelming majority of gun dealers do not sell a single crime gun," he said. "A small percentage of dealers sell virtually all the crime guns. The good gun dealers don't like that any more than the government of Mexico." Counsel for the defense anticipated the plaintiff's arguments, describing the suit as a new coat of paint on previous unsuccessful industry lawsuits. "At bottom, this case implicates a clash of national values," they wrote in a motion to dismiss in district court. "By seeking to bankrupt U.S. gun makers, this gambit not only threatens America's constitutional freedoms, but also the careful balance of firearms regulations set by Congress and state legislatures." Ultimately, they argued that Mexico's gun violence problem was rooted in the fact that the government was unable to control cartel violence within its borders, and not through predatory conduct by manufacturers. Less fear, more freedom. Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson felt he understood both sides of the issue. The top cop in Texas's largest county also owns a small gun shop in Alpine, one of just three brick-and-mortar dealers in the region. Though Dodson sells much of his stock to locals, he still has to follow protocol by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF. The first step is having a potential buyer fill out a form that logs information about the product they'd like to purchase and a series of yes or no questions about the applicant's criminal record, drug use, and medical history. The self-reported data is then bolstered by a formal background check. If the applicant clears the background check, they can walk out of the store with the firearm. Once the gun is off the books, Dodson's responsibility technically ends there, regardless of what happens to the gun down the line. "I don't think they should be able to come back and sue me when I did exactly what my license and license instructors told me to do," he said. Dodson said that some of his customers do buy multiple guns from him, but that they're typically cowboy guns, single-action rifles and revolvers snapped up by collectors. He said that he had self-reported a customer who was purchasing large numbers of firearms and reselling them to the ATF, who carried out a sting operation that revealed that customer's role in a trafficking scheme. In another incident, the agency approached him, a customer of Dodson's who had only ever bought small pistols from him, turned out to have been buying cartel-favored guns in bulk in El Paso. From a law enforcement perspective, Dodson said it's difficult to trace southbound weapons. His department has caught gun smugglers headed south on camera, but if those same smugglers don't return to Brewster County, there's little action he can take. "We deal with northbound traffic for the most part," he explained. "If a guy goes down to the border and disappears out of my sight, well, you've got to catch him doing that." On the international stage, Lowy hoped that the suit would help solve numerous northbound traffic problems. As the cartels wrest control from Mexican law enforcement, smuggling of humans and drugs poses increased risk to Americans and Mexicans alike. The conduct of the U.S. gun industry is having horrific effects on both sides, he said. Lowy is representing Mexico in court alongside renowned Austin-based antitrust lawyer Steve Shadowin. Per reporting by Reuters, Shadowin's firm slashed their rates in half in support of the case when it was originally presented to a federal court in 2021 and received numerous inquiries and offers of help from other firms. Though various media outlets reported a potential settlement in the billions, the exact scale of damages has yet to be determined. Mexico will also seek injunctive relief in the form of major industry-wide change, a cause that other countries have supported. In March 2023, the governments of Antigua and Barbuda, Belize, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and Trinidad and Tobago filed an amicus curiae brief in support of Mexico, hoping to address their own gun violence problems. Mexico stated publicly that the injunctive relief is extraordinarily important, Lowy explained. That's having the court require the industry to behave responsibly in a way that does not arm the cartels. The plaintiffs also seek something intangible. Life in Mexico would be a far different place, their complaint reads. Existence for the Mexican people would be far different if life could be led without dangers and threats from the armed cartels. Less fear, more freedom to gather together and enjoy life.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fourth Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, February 8, 2024. City County meet to discuss Rooney Park water wells. The County Commissioner at Court and City Council met in a joint session Tuesday afternoon at the Pecos County Courthouse to discuss options for two water wells the county wants to dig at Rooney Park to provide irrigation for the park. Rooney Park is a county-owned park located inside city limits. The city provides water for the Comanche Springs Pool as well as the large and small community hall buildings at the park. The county would drill two wells below 400 to 600 feet to reach the Trinity Sands Aquifer to be used for watering the grass and trees, not for drinking water. The city and county have an agreement that expires December 2025. On our side, what we're thinking about is metering the county buildings, county properties, water usage, water consumption minus Rooney Park, and the swimming pool, said Mayor Paul Casillas. Fort Stockton City Manager Frank Rodriguez said that the whole purpose was to hear what the county is offering before the agreement ends next year, and at the same time for the city to listen, because when that agreement ends, that means that the county is subject to pay for the water use at the park. County Judge Joe Schuster said that the water costs at Rooney Park are pretty astronomical, and the county's looking for a better way to come up with a solution. I think we've asked several different ways, but one of the ways was if the city would absorb the cost of the water, that the county would continue to maintain and take care of Rooney Park, because Rooney Park basically is utilized by the people of Fort Stockton. It's a county park, but we all know that 99.9% of the people in that park are from Fort Stockton, so it is a benefit for the community. Schuster said that it would cost approximately $500,000 to $750,000 to drill for water at the two existing wells, which the county could do. We could go through the water district here and request that those two wells be reutilized. Schuster said the wells were no longer used because of an agreement between the city and county back then in the 1930s. City Secretary Nina Cantu said the city ordinance does not allow for new wells to be drilled, so the county would need to request a variance. Council member Darren Hodges said he was all for that, saying that the park is better suited for well water and that using city water for irrigation is a waste. Schuster added that the county spent $7.5 million for a reverse osmosis plant, and the city contributed $1.5 million, and prior to that, the county paid for a water line leading to Belding Farms. Today's prices for water for us to just put on the ground is pretty high, so we're asking for some relief. Schuster said that two wells at the park would cost between $60,000 and $80,000 because it isn't for human consumption, and the county would still purchase water for the pool and the community halls. We have to start planning right now if we're going to do this and drill two wells and put a tank on top of a hill next to the community hall and run our own water system for irrigation. We need to start doing that now. Rodriguez said 4.5 million gallons of water per year is used at the park, and the county pays $180,000 a year for it. The city is well versed on drilling water wells, having spent about $1 million for a well at Belding. Our water wells for human consumption are extremely expensive, and now we have to take care of the easement, which was also extremely expensive. It's just easier to water the park with the water well that's not for human consumption. Schuster wants to drill to the Trinity Sands Aquifer below the Edwards Trinity Aquifer, where the area's water comes from, but it said there's a question as to what the Trinity Sands Aquifer has available. If it works, the water would be pumped to a tank for the irrigation system at the park. He would also like to put in infrastructure that the city water is available, that the county could ask for city water if the park water system goes down for whatever reason. The aquifer is not available year-round. For that reason, we need a backup. Schuster asked if the city would provide a monetary help for the project, not knowing what that exact figure would be. I'd like to see the numbers on what it would cost. For Stockton, Councilmember Bernal said that once those numbers are available, both sides can meet again and figure it out. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get the numbers, Schuster replied. We're going to go ahead and plan for on doing what we discussed today because it's got to be done. School Board approves grant to Fort Stockton Educational Foundation. In an approximately 15-minute meeting Friday afternoon, the school board, in a special meeting to approve a grant to the newly formed Fort Stockton Educational Foundation to be used for scholarships for high school students who meet certain criteria, which has not yet been decided. Prior to voting, Superintendent Zamora said the attorneys looked at the grant and said legally it was good to go. Basically, what it says is that the foundation represents the best interests of what the district wants, and it enables the district to legally grant said foundation the amount of $3 million. Everything has been culminating to this, and it has been vetted by our attorneys. The board approved the grant by a unanimous vote. The Education Foundation consists of three school board members. At the January 22nd school board meetings, Zamora said, if we get lucky and it's invested properly in everything, at a minimum, it's going to give us 5 or 6 years of scholarships for our kids that meet those criteria and possibly even longer. The scholarship amount is set at $5,000 and it's available to every senior who meets the criteria. The board discussed and approved a T-ball practice field project with the city of Fort Stockton at the fields behind Alamo Elementary. Behind Alamo, there are two portions of what you'd call batting cages meant for T-ball that were put up last year with the permission of the district. The city put those up, and working with the rec department, they're requesting that we allow for them to add some shaded structures and a seating area for the kids to practice. Zamora said that if the district requires that land in the future, it can remove the structures, but I don't believe that is the case. You all know how I feel about anything that benefits our kids in the community. Schematics presented the board showed the extending the dugouts by 5 feet and adding a bench or seating arrangements for the players. Add shade to dugouts and tarps and add an outfield fence to the field. I'd like to point out that Frank Rodriguez, from the city intends at some time this coming winter to clear out the back part of our Schuster baseball fields so that we can look at the future and building something permanent that has turf, Zamora said. I just wanted to throw that out there, that this is not a forever thing. This is a something that we can make better now thing, and hopefully we can expand on it. Ruby Bernal with the City Recreation Department said that the project is something that could help them this year because of the large number of kids participating. T-ball season, just like how we did the baseball season, adding that basketball is just now getting started because of the large number of participants. This would just help us so that we can keep the kids in, and that way we can be done before the school lets out. Bernal added that the project, just a practice field, but regular games may also be held there. The board approved the project by unanimous vote. DPS arrests more than 50 in human trafficking operations. During January 2024, as part of Human Trafficking Awareness Month, the DPS Criminal Investigations Division conducted numerous operations throughout West Texas. The goal of these operations was to target individuals seeking to exploit and victimize trafficking victims and to identify and apprehend individuals suspected of being involved in trafficking by using various websites to solicit sexual acts. Multiple agencies assisted in these investigations, including DPS-CID, DPS Intelligence, and Counterterrorism, Texas Highway Patrol, and other divisions. This was a very successful operation due to the outstanding collaboration of multiple agencies working towards combating human trafficking. Human trafficking is on the rise, and we need the community's assistance in reporting trafficking. If you see something, please say something. In addition, DPS special agents work jointly with other organizations on a human trafficking operation that targeted massage parlors in Midland County. The goal was to target massage parlors suspected of participating in prostitution to locate human trafficking victims or suspects. The operation resulted in the arrest of 4 suspects for prostitution. 1 was arrested for operating without a massage license. These investigations highlight the partnership between federal, local, and state law enforcement partners working together to combat crime. If you are a victim of human trafficking or have information about this type of criminal activity, contact the National Human Trafficking Hotline at 888-373-7888. All reports are confidential. Presbyterian Church Ash Wednesday services will be observed from February 14th at 7 p.m. at the sanctuary. The entire community is invited to join as we begin the observance of Lent with worship, including the imposition of ashes. This is one of the most meaningful services of the church year. Ash Wednesday services at St. Stephen's. St. Stephen's Episcopal Church will have Ash Wednesday services at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February 14th. The service will include imposition of ashes followed by Eucharist and will be led by Father Michael Wallens. Everyone is welcome. Please join us for more information. Call 828-243-5005. Do something. Places to go and things to do. February 9th, 2023, Outstanding Citizen of the Year nominations due at the Chamber of Commerce by 5. The recipient will be revealed at the annual banquet. February 9th, for Stockton Panthers basketball versus Greenwood at the Bill in Virginia Special Events Center, 7:30. February 9th, Prowler softball scrimmage versus Big Spring, 5-7 p.m. February 10th, Stockton Market, Zero Stone Park, noon to 4. February 13th, Panthers basketball at Pecos, 6 p.m. February 15 to 17, Prowler varsity softball at Cahoba Tournament, February 15 to 17, Prowlers Junior Varsity Softball at Pecos Tournament. February 16, Daddy Daughter Dance will be presented by 4-H from 6 to 8 at the Community Hall. Cost is $10. RSVP it to 336-2541. February 17, Fort Stockton Baseball Alumni Game, 1 p.m. February 20th, Prowler Softball at Odessa Permian, 5 p.m., JV at 7. February 20th, Panthers Baseball at Brownfield, 4 to 6:30. February 20th, Ministerial Alliance Luncheon at St. Stephen's and First Presbyterian, 11:45 a.m. February 22nd, Fort Stockton Historical Society Banquet, details TBA, to be announced. February 23rd, Fort Stockton Community Theater presents Southern Hospitality, a comedy in two acts at the theater, 102 South Nelson. February 24th, Fort Stockton Market, Zero Stone Pork, noon to 4. February 27th, Ministerial Alliance Lenten Luncheon at Believers Fellowship and Emmanuel Baptist Church, 11:45 a.m. February 29th, 2024 Annual Chamber Banquet, 6 p.m. at the Civic Center. March 5th, Ministerial Alliance Lenten Luncheon at First Baptist Church, 11:45. March 12th, Lenten Luncheon at First Methodist and First Christian, 11:45. March 19th, Lenten Luncheon at Our Lady of Guadalupe, 11:45.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, February 1st. Chest pain, hospital, now. The story was written by Ruby Briggs. Smokey does not have a column this week, and the Briggs family would just like to update the communities we call home about why that is. At 2:30 a.m. on Sunday morning, Smokey sat bolt upright in bed and said, "Chest pain, hospital, now." We had several very good friends staying with our family that night, and they helped get Smokey in the car and to the emergency room in Monahans. He was having severe chest pain, trouble breathing, and was in and out of mental clarity. We were transferred once to Odessa Regional Medical Center and then again to Medical Center Hospital, both in Odessa. We spent the majority of Sunday morning either waiting to be seen or doing some sort of diagnostic testing. His lungs filled with fluid and blood, his body was shutting down, and he was sedated and intubated, and they handed the duty of breathing over to a ventilator. The move to MCH and the team who took on his case there is what saved his life. MCH is where he was properly diagnosed, a treatment plan was outlined, and a cardiac surgeon was brought in to do the work. Dr. Garcia, MCH ICU, we will never be able to thank you enough. Smokey's care team at MCH is phenomenal. They have fought for our dad like he was their own family, and it has been a hard and bloody fight. Smokey had a catastrophic failure of the artificial aortic heart valve he had placed in 2018. The valve should be a tricuspid three-leafed valve, and one of the leaves completely tore away from the heart, falling inward into the valve. This left a gaping hole in the valve and resulted in blood pooling in the heart and not circulating properly through the rest of his body. The fluid in his lungs was pulmonary edema. We were warned that our outlook was not good. This was a one in a million, and we needed to prepare ourselves for the absolute worst, but that this was his only shot. He would not survive a transfer to a larger hospital. We went into emergency open-heart surgery at 6:37 p.m. on Sunday. We came out of open-heart surgery at around 10 p.m. Our surgeon walked out and told us Smokey was alive. He had a new aortic heart valve and was being wheeled into recovery to see if he could make it through the night. As I write this, it is 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday morning, and not only is Smokey alive, but he is off the ventilator and working on coming off of chemical life support and starting physical therapy and movement today. Our doctors have no explanation for his recovery other than, quote, "We do not know how, but he is a little better," end quote. His numbers continue to improve. His body is coming back online. He is eating and drinking a little today. Smokey is not out of the woods yet, but our future looks much brighter than it did Sunday evening. Our conversation as a family Sunday night changed from choosing a funeral home to oversee his burial to choosing a cardiologist to oversee his recovery. The next few days and then next few weeks will hold many questions as to the potential damage to his body and what his recovery will entail. He has a long and difficult recovery in front of him regardless, but he is here with us and alive. His brain and his memory appear to be intact, and thus we are very hopeful that he will continue to improve and recover physically and spiritually as well. We are so very, very blessed to have the support system we do. We don't know what we would do without our little families at the News and the Enterprise, or the family, friends, and communities we have in our lives. The outpouring of support we have received since this happened has been monumental and staggering. Words will never properly express how grateful we are for every offer to help, every bit of support, and every voice lifted to God on Smokey's behalf. Prayers and love have seen us through this so far, and we thank you all so much for that. Today we are doing well, spirits are brighter, and we are optimistic about the future. Our family is together, and we have good friends tagging in and out as help and support. Smokey is doing well enough to complain about the selection of Jell-O flavors available, and we are taking it as a good sign. We ask for your prayers for a continued recovery, and thank everyone again for the support, help, love, and prayers. Traffic stop nets 72 grams of meth. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A routine traffic stop for failing to drive in a single marked lane has resulted in taking more than 70 grams of suspected methamphetamine off the streets. The traffic stop was made by deputies of the Ward County Sheriff's Office at approximately 3 a.m. on January 23rd on Interstate 20 near Exit 83. According to Sheriff Ferran Valle, quote, "Deputies conducted a traffic stop on a gold Chevrolet pickup and made contact with the driver, who was identified as Billy Joe Wells, age 56, of Irving," end quote. Deputies conducted a consensual search of the vehicle and its contents. Quote, "Deputies found over 72 grams of a crystalline substance believed to be methamphetamine." Wells was subsequently arrested and taken to Ward County Jail and charged with possession of controlled substance penalty group 1, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, a second-degree felony. Wells's bond was set at $20,000, and he remains in custody in lieu of posting the bond. Sheriff warns about scam calls. Ward County Sheriff Ferran Valle told the News on Tuesday afternoon, the office has been receiving several complaints in regards of calls advising the call receiver has an active warrant for their arrest in Ward County, end quote. Information indicates the caller has another person on the line on a three-way call identifying themselves as a judge in Ward County. The caller is given instructions on how to clear up the warrant by paying a fee to a cryptocurrency machine, usually in Odessa, Valle said. Quote, "The Ward County Sheriff's Office will not call anyone and collect money on an active warrant. If you believe you are a victim of the scam, you can call our office at 432-943-6703 to report the incident, he added. PBA acquires security preferred title. Permian Basin Abstract Company, also known as PBA, headquartered in Andrews, has announced the acquisition of Security Preferred Title, LLC, of Monahans. As West Texas's and the Permian Basin's leading title insurance provider, PBA has seen significant growth over the past decade. Originally known as Andrews Abstract and serving Andrews County, PBA has grown to include offices in Seminole, Pecos, Fort Stockton, and now Monahans. Licensed in multiple counties, PBA is excited to serve the people of Monahans and Ward County. Quote, as experts in real estate title insurance and settlement, PBA looks forward to continuing the customer-focused service of Security Preferred Title and providing an exceptional closing experience, Senior Vice President Lance L. Lovelady said. Rivera has ties to pro wrestling. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. Well-known local Arcadio Rivera went to college at West Texas State University, now known as West Texas A&M University, in the early 70s. Rivera, a 1971 graduate of Marfa High School, went to West Texas State to play football. During his time at WTSU, he met and developed close friendships with some young men who would one day become household names to the world of pro wrestling. Rivera palled around with four football teammates who would one day be better known in the wrestling world rather than on the gridiron. Stan Hansen, also known as Stan the Lariat Hansen, Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, Tully Blanchard, wrestled under his own name, and Merced Solis, known in wrestling as Tito Santana. Football has always been a big deal in Texas, but it has also turned out some of the best-known professional wrestlers known in the business. Some of these talented wrestlers came out of promotions like World Class Championship Wrestling, Houston Wrestling, and Southwest Championship Wrestling, but many attended West Texas State University, located in the small town of Canyon, about 20 miles south of Amarillo. Terry Funk, son of legendary wrestling promoter Dory Funk Sr., was essentially the reason that West Texas State University became known as Pro Wrestling University. Funk competed in amateur wrestling and football at WTSU before beginning his career of wrestling. The Funks had a ranch in the Amarillo area and often made the 20-mile trip into Canyon to scout football players and get them interested in the wrestling profession. Quote, the Funks would come in and get us to go spend time out at the ranch. We got to meet Ric Flair one time. He and Terry were friends. We were just a bunch of kids who dreamed of playing professional football, but the Funks' influence sure put some of them on a completely different course, said Rivera. One of Rivera's college friends was Tully Blanchard, who was born into the wrestling business. Blanchard's dad, Joe, was an American Wrestling Association star wrestler and a promoter. But young Blanchard wanted to play football, which he did as a quarterback and defensive end for the West Texas State Buffaloes, before turning his attention to the family business. Another teammate of Rivera and Blanchard was Ted DiBiase. DiBiase was at WTSU to play football also, but DiBiase's football career was short because he needed money. The Funk family trained him, and he debuted his wrestling career in the mid-70s in Amarillo. DiBiase made a name for himself as the Million Dollar Man and became known as one of the best heel characters, playing the part of a truly bad person in World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE. He was part of a long-running storyline involving Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, and Randy Savage. He later had storylines with wrestlers such as Jake the Snake Roberts, The Ultimate Warrior, and Dusty Rhodes. DiBiase was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2010. Another of the Friends, Stan Hansen, was personally recruited and trained by the Funk family. Hansen went on to begin his wrestling career in 1973, while also playing for the Detroit Wheels of the World Football League. Hansen started wrestling full-time in 1975 when the World Football League folded. Hansen wrestled mainly for New Japan and All Japan wrestling organizations. Merced Solis became known as Tito Santana in the wrestling world, but while in school at WTSU, he played tight end, while Blanchard was quarterback for the Buffaloes, and after graduation signed on with the Kansas City Chiefs, but was cut during training camp. He went on to play one season for the Canadian Football League's BC Lions. It was Tully Blanchard who helped Santana break into the wrestling business in the mid-70s, setting him up to have a great wrestling career. Santana joined WWE in 1979, had a couple of short stints in other wrestling promotions, and returned to WWE in 1983. While wrestling in the WWE, Santana became the first Mexican-American wrestler to win the Intercontinental Championship and held that title for 217 days. Santana and Hulk Hogan are the only two wrestlers to appear in the first 9 WrestleMania events, wrestling's equivalent to football's Super Bowl. Santana was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2004. Quote, "Tito is the only one I still keep in touch with now. After he retired from wrestling, he became a teacher. He graduated with a physical education major and a minor in Spanish, and just retired from 25 years of teaching Spanish at Eisenhower Middle School in Roxbury, New Jersey, last June," said Rivera. Rivera himself went on to become a teacher and coach in Stanton after graduating from WTSU. He taught there for 4 years and then taught for 1 year at Post before becoming a teacher coach at Monahans High School from 1980 to 2008. In 2009, Rivera took the job of adult misdemeanor probation officer for Ward County. Oddly enough, West Texas State University has turned out a list of successful wrestlers who started out playing football. That impressive list includes Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk, Frank Goodish, also known as Bruiser Brody, and Barry Windham, to name just a few. Quote, "I think back to those days and remember all the good times the 5 of us had together. One of my really good memories is about one winter. Snow is pretty common up around Amarillo, but a couple of the guys were from the south and had never seen snow, so when we had a 5-foot snowstorm and classes were canceled, we were part of a campus-wide snowball fight, dorm against dorm. We really had some good times back in the day," said Rivera.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.